Chapter 1. Fermentation as a Coevolutionary Force. Most of the information you will find in this book pertains to techniques for fermenting delicious, nutritious foods and beverages for human consumption. In this context, fermentation is the transformation of food by various bacteria, fungi, and the enzymes they produce. People harness this transformative power in order to produce alcohol, to preserve food, and to make it more digestible, less toxic, and/or more delicious. By some estimates, as much as 1/3 of all food eaten by human beings worldwide is fermented, and fermented food production, taken as a whole, constitutes one of the world's largest industries. Fermentation has played an instrumental role in human cultural evolution, as we shall explore. It is important to recognize, however, that fermentation is a natural phenomenon much broader than human culinary practices. Cells in our bodies are capable of fermentation. In other words, humans did not invent or create fermentation. It would be more accurate to state that fermentation created us. Bacteria, our ancestors and co-evolutionary partners. Biologists use the term fermentation to describe anaerobic metabolism, the production of energy from nutrients without oxygen. Fermenting bacteria are thought to have emerged relatively early from the primordial prebiotic soup, before the atmosphere had a sufficient concentration of oxygen to support or evolve aerobic life forms. In the first 2 billion years of life on Earth, bacteria, the only inhabitants, continuously transformed the planet's surface and atmosphere and invented all of life's essential miniaturized chemical systems, writes biologist Lynn Margulis. The research of Margulis and others has convinced many biologists that symbiotic relationships between fermenting bacteria and other early single-cell life forms became permanently embodied as the first eukaryotic cells that plants, animals, and fungi comprise. As Margulis and Dorian Sagan explain in their book, Microcosmos, the symbiosis may have begun as a predator-prey relationship. Eventually, some of the prey evolved a tolerance for their aerobic predators, which then remained alive and well in the food-rich interior of the host. Two types of organisms used the products of each other's metabolisms. As they reproduced inside the invaded cells without causing harm, the predators gave up their independent ways and moved in for good. Evolution derived from such symbiosis is known as symbiogenesis. Microbiologists Serene Sonia and Leo G. Matthew elaborate on the concept. Symbiogenesis with thousands of different bacterial genes has decisively enriched the limited metabolic potential of eukaryotic organisms, accelerating and facilitating their adaptation much more than would have been achieved by random mutation alone. Bacterial fermentation processes have been part of the context for all life. Fermentation plays such a broad and vital role in nutrient cycling that all beings co-evolved with it, ourselves included. Through symbiosis and coevolution, bacteria fused into new forms, spawning all other life. For the past 1 billion years, members of the bacteria superkingdom have functioned as a major selective force shaping eukaryotic evolution, state molecular biologists Jian Xu and Jeffrey I. Gordon. Co-evolved symbiotic relationships between bacteria and multicellular organisms are a prominent feature of life on Earth. The importance of bacteria and our bacterial interactions cannot be overstated. We could not exist or function without our bacterial partners. Like all complex multicellular life forms, the human body is host to an elaborate indigenous biota. Some geneticists argue that we are a composite of many species, with a genetic landscape that encompasses not only the human genome, but also those of our bacterial symbionts. In our bodies, bacteria outnumber the cells containing our unique DNA by more than 10 to 1. The vast majority of these bacteria, a mind-boggling 100 trillion, or 10 to the 14th power, in number, are found in our intestines. Bacteria break down nutrients we would not otherwise be able to digest and play an important role, just beginning to be recognized in regulating the balance between energy use and storage. Intestinal bacteria produce certain necessary nutrients for us, including B and K vitamins. They provide us with vital defense by outcompeting invading pathogens for ecological niches and metabolic substrates. In addition, intestinal bacteria are able to modulate expression of some of our genes, related to diverse and fundamental physiological functions, including immune response. Evidence of an active dialogue is rapidly unfolding between intestinal bacteria and the immune cells of the intestine linings. That's just the bacteria in our intestines. On our body's surfaces, microbial communities exist in a great range of distinct niches. For example, hairy, moist underarms lie a short distance from smooth, dry forearms, but these two niches are likely as ecologically dissimilar as rainforests are to deserts, observed a 2009 study of the genetic diversity of skin bacteria. Bacteria inhabit all our surfaces, particularly the warmer, sweaty places that stay moist, as well as our eyes, upper respiratory tract, and orifices. More than 700 species have been detected in the healthy oral cavity. Even our reproduction requires fermentation. The human vagina has been found to secrete glycogen that supports an indigenous population of lactobacilli, which ferment the glycogen into lactic acid, thereby protecting the vagina from pathogenic bacteria, which cannot survive in an acid environment. The presence of lactobacilli as a part of the normal vaginal flora is an important component of reproductive health. Our indigenous bacteria protect us everywhere and enable us to function in myriad ways that are just beginning to be understood. From an evolutionary perspective, this extensive microbiota endows us with functional features that we have not had to evolve ourselves. This is a miracle of coevolution. The bacteria that coexist with us in our bodies enable us to exist. Microbiologist Michael Wilson notes that each exposed surface of a human being is colonized by microbes exquisitely adapted to that particular environment. Yet the dynamics of these microbial populations and how they interact with our bodies are still largely unknown. A 2008 comparative genomics analysis of lactic acid bacteria acknowledges that research is just now beginning to scratch the surface of the complex relationship between humans and their microbiota. Bacteria are such effective coevolutionary partners because they are highly adaptable and mutable. Bacteria continually monitor their external and internal environments and compute functional outputs based on information provided by their sensory apparatus, explains bacterial geneticist James Shapiro, who reports multiple widespread bacterial systems for mobilizing and engineering DNA molecules. In contrast with our eukaryotic cells with fixed genetic material, prokaryotic bacteria have free-floating genes, which they frequently exchange. For this reason, some microbiologists consider it inappropriate to view bacteria as distinct species. There are no species in prokaryotes, state Soreen Sonia and Leo G. Matthew. Bacteria are much more of a continuum, explains Lynn Margulis. They just pick up genes, they throw away genes, and they are very flexible about that. Matthew and Sonia describe a bacterial genetic free market in which each bacterium can be compared to a two-way broadcasting station, using genes as information molecules. Genes are carried by a bacterium only when needed, as a human may carry sophisticated tools. The emerging details of gene transfer are fascinating. In addition to exchanging genes directly with other bacteria, bacteria have receptors to receive genes from prophages, which Sonia and Matthew call a unique type of biological but inanimate construction, a micro-robot for gene exchanges, organized like an ultra-microscopic syringe with a hollow container, head, and an ultra-microscopic needle, tail. This exclusively bacterial type of instrument for gene exchange among living beings may be carried across large distances by water, wind, animals, etc. With so many mechanisms for genetic exchange, all the world's bacteria essentially have access to a single gene pool and hence to the adaptive mechanisms of the entire bacteria kingdom, summarize Margulis and Sagan. Beyond genetic flexibility, bacteria utilize sophisticated mechanisms for intercellular communication and even have the ability to commandeer the basic cell biology of higher plants and animals to meet their own needs, writes geneticist James Shapiro. A new understanding of bacteria is emerging. Far from being simplistic, lower forms of life, they are becoming recognized as highly evolved with elaborate systems for adaptability and resilience. In any particular environment, some subset of the total bacterial gene pool is present. Interesting research recently identified a new class of enzymes produced by marine bacteria, Zobelia galactonivorans, that can digest a polysaccharide called porphyrin, found in some seaweed, including nori, where the bacteria were found. Through genome analysis, investigators identified specific genes in the bacteria that produce the enzyme. Then, searching gene sequencing databases, the investigators found the same genes in bacteria in the intestines of Japanese populations, but not North Americans. This indicates that seaweeds with associated marine bacteria may have been the route by which these novel enzymes were acquired in human gut bacteria, conclude the researchers, elaborating that contact with non-sterile food may be a general factor in enzyme diversity in human gut microbes. What this means is that, to some degree, the microbes on the food we eat determine our metabolic capabilities. This finding raises huge questions about both the past and the future. It remains to be determined how, during human evolution, changes in food production and preparation, such as agriculture and cooking, have influenced the intestinal microbiota, notes a discussion in the journal Nature. Consumption of hyperhygienic, mass-produced, highly processed, and calorie-dense foods is testing how rapidly the microbiota of individuals in industrialized countries can adapt, while being deprived of the environmental reservoirs of microbial genes that allow adaptation by lateral transfer. We need not continue to deprive ourselves. If sterilized, processed food is starving our microbiota of genetic stimulation. Live culture foods that are rich depositories of bacterial genes are part of our human cultural legacy everywhere. Through dietary change, we can indulge ourselves and eat a variety of bacteria-rich living foods, precisely in order to build such genetic reservoirs inside our intestines, to enhance our metabolic capabilities, our immune function, and many other regulatory physiological functions. Humans are not unique in having co-evolved with bacterial symbionts. Plants also co-evolved with and are dependent upon bacterial partners. A symbiotic relationship between photosynthesizing bacteria and other prokaryotes is thought by many to be the origin of the photosynthesizing chloroplasts in plant cells. The soil around plant roots makes up what is known as the rhizosphere, where plants find sustenance through elaborate interaction with a multifaceted soil food web. We know more about the stars in the sky than about the soil under our feet, points out soil microbiologist Elaine Ingham. Roots and their surfaces for soil interaction are actually far more elaborate than meets the eye. A single rye plant, growing but a season, has millions of rootlets, altogether running an estimated 680 miles, or 1,094 kilometers, and each of the rootlets is covered with still smaller root hairs, numbering in the billions on each plant, altogether running 6,600 miles, or 10,600 kilometers. All these microscopic root hairs release exudates into the soil, highly regulated excretions including sugars, amino acids, enzymes, and many other nutrients and unique chemical compounds, creating a very selective environment in which they literally call the proper bacteria to the area where the plant is growing, according to Stephen Harrod Buhner. Like us, plants rely on bacteria for their survival and have evolved elaborate mechanisms for attracting and interacting with them. Because we have evolved eating both plants and animals, and have co-evolved with them, Our co-evolutionary histories encompass not only the plants and animals themselves, but also their microbial associates. It is the ubiquitous presence of these life forms, present from the very beginning but invisible until the past few centuries, which results in the ferments, nearly all prehistoric, that we love to eat and drink. The ferments, in spontaneously occurring forms, predate our consciousness of how to manipulate conditions so as to guide their development. But our consciousness did develop, and as part of that, so did the fermentation arts. The ferment itself, and our ability to produce it, is as much a product of coevolution as the person, plant, yeast, or bacterium. Thus, coevolution encompasses even culture. Fermentation and culture. What exactly is culture? In contrast with the realm of biological reproduction, where information is coded and copied as genes, in the cultural realm, information is encoded as memes. Memes are transmitted through words, concepts, images, processes, abstractions, stories, pictures, books, films, photographs, computer programs, ledgers, secret family recipes, life lessons like learning to identify edible plants, learning to garden, learning to cook, learning to fish, learning to procure, use, and preserve precious food resources. Fermenting. It is largely our history of interacting with plants and associated microbes that gives rise to what we call culture. After all, the word culture comes from the Latin cultura, a form of the verb colere, to cultivate or till. The first definition of culture in the Oxford English Dictionary is simply the cultivation of land and derived senses. Through these derived senses, and the many varied manifestations of cultivation, ideas of what could be cultivated grew. People culture pearls, we culture cells, and we culture milk. We practice aquaculture, viticulture, and horticulture, not to mention popular culture. Many people work hard to imbue their children with culture. Sometimes people decry cultural appropriation or defend cultural purity. Culture begins with cultivating the land, planting seeds, bringing intentionality to cycles that we act to perpetuate. Indeed, a more ancient origin of the word culture is the Indo-European root quel, meaning to revolve, from which cycle, circle, chakra, and many other words, along with culture, are derived. Culture is cultivation, but it is not an isolated act. It is, by definition, part of a cyclical ongoing process, passed from generation to generation. As my exploration of fermentation unfolds, I keep coming back to the profound significance of the fact that we use the same word, culture, to describe the community of bacteria that transform milk into yogurt, as well as the practice of subsistence itself, language, music, art, literature, science, spiritual practices, belief systems, and all that human beings seek to perpetuate in our varied and overlapping collective existences. As described earlier, successful coexistence with microbes in our midst is a biological imperative, and the fermentation arts are human cultural manifestations of this essential fact. If we are to enjoy surpluses of food, then we must have strategies for preserving them in the presence of the microbial ecology, such as it is. Clearly, as a group, fermented foods and beverages are more than incidental culinary novelties. They appear to be found in some form in every culinary tradition. I have searched, without success, for examples of cultures that do not incorporate any form of fermentation. Indeed, ferments are central features of many, perhaps even most, cuisines. Immigrants crossing continents and oceans, their only belongings, the ones they could carry, have often brought their sourdoughs and other starters with them, or at the very least, their fermentation knowledge and practices. The fermentation starters themselves, and the knowledge of how to use them, are tangible embodiments of culture, deeply embedded in our desire and cravings, not lightly abandoned. How can we even imagine the cultural realm without alcoholic beverages? Though some religions and nations ban alcohol altogether, thus defining themselves in opposition to it, alcohol is known and used everywhere, and of widespread importance in ritual, ceremony, and celebration. Their preeminence and universal allure, what might be called their biological, social, and religious imperatives, make them significant in understanding the development of our species and its cultures, states anthropologist Patrick E. McGovern, who has identified alcohol residues in 9,000-year-old pottery shards. Our species' intimate relationship with fermented beverages over millions of years has, in large measure, made us what we are today. Most people seem to enjoy manipulating our gift and burden of consciousness, and do so by whatever means available. Alcohol has been far and away the most widely available and widely used intoxicant. We do not know the origins of alcohol. The alcohol that Professor McGovern identified from the Neolithic settlement of Jiahu in China was made from a mixture of rice, honey, and fruit. It would appear that these early human alcohol makers were combining available carbohydrate and yeast sources, however they might have conceptualized the process. Is it possible that, rather than humans discovering alcohol and mastering its production, we evolved, always already knowing it? Anthropologist Mikhail John Azved points out that all vertebrate species are equipped with a hepatic enzyme system with which to metabolize alcohol. Many animals have been documented consuming alcohol in their natural habitats. One of them, a daily consumer of alcohol in the Malaysian jungle, is the pentailed tree shrew, Ptilocercus lowi. Interestingly, this mammal is considered to be the morphologically least derived living descendant of early ancestors of primates, regarded as a living model for the ancestral lineage from which primates radiated. The alcohol these tree shrews consume occurs naturally on the Bertram palm, Eugiosona tristis, on specialized flower buds that harbor a fermenting yeast community, and the tree shrews are pollinators for the Bertram palm. This tree, its pollinating shrews, and the fermenting yeast community all co-evolved this arrangement together. It would be absurd to think of one species as the primary actor in this mutualistic community. As the primate family diverged from the tree shrews, it lost such highly specialized alcohol-laced relationships. But our primate and humanoid ancestors presumably ate lots of fruit, which ferments when ripe, especially quickly in the warm and wet jungle climate. Biologist Robert Dudley theorizes that our precursors were routinely exposed to alcohol and fruit, and that this exposure in turn elicited corresponding physiological adaptations and preferences over an evolutionary timescale that are retained in modern humans. While alcohol is present in fruits at low concentrations compared with alcoholic beverages, the fleeting availability of seasonal fruits encourages gorging. I know I respond to plentiful ripe berries that way, and I am not unique in this regard. Addiction researcher Ronald Siegel describes animals responding to fallen, split, fermenting durian fruits in Malaysia. A menagerie of jungle beasts, alerted by the ripening odor, parade to the fallen fruit. Elephants that may have migrated from great distances sometimes gorge themselves on the fermented fruit remaining on the ground. They start swaying in a lethargic manner. The monkeys frequently lose motor coordination, have difficulty climbing, and start head shaking. The flying foxes, which are the largest bats in the world and have the same tastes as humans, feed at night on mostly fermented and rotten fruit, which fouls the bat's sonar, thus causing navigational difficulties. The bats keep falling down and waddling on the ground. Alcohol forms part of an intricate web of interrelationships between yeasts, plants, and animals as diverse as the fruit fly, elephant, and human for their mutual benefit and propagation, summarizes Patrick McGovern. Maybe our primate progenitors periodically participated in festivities similar to the Malaysian jungle feast described above and enjoyed the alterations alcohol provides. If this is the case, then our human lineage, rather than discovering alcohol, knew it all along, evolved with it, and applied our growing conceptual capabilities and tool-making skills to assure a steady supply. By the time we became distinctly human 100,000 years ago, we would have known where there were certain fruits we could collect to make fermented beverages, argues McGovern. we would have been very deliberate about going at the right time of the year to collect grains, fruits, and tubers, and making them into beverages at the beginning of the human race. Understanding how to manipulate conditions to make alcohol and being able to share that information are huge milestones in our cultural evolution. Even more important, or at least more necessary at a day-to-day level, is the cultural information required to effectively store food. At least a rudimentary knowledge of food storage strategies is required in order to survive without daily hunting and gathering. The only way people could escape from a daily preoccupation with feeding themselves was by acquiring the ability to preserve food for the future. Fermentation rhythm. Blair Nosen, Detroit, Michigan. The rhythms of fermentation have become a part of my life in a way that is so deeply satisfying. I feel that they'll stay with me for a long time. Fermentation requires cycles of us to return to inspect, to refresh and renew. Just as Shabbat comes once a week, so too do I renew my batch of yogurt every Saturday or Sunday and check whatever else is brewing under my kitchen counter. I feel grateful for these rhythms because they help me feel rooted in a world without grounding, and they help me engage with a past where humans' daily lives were suffused with awareness of the cycles of our climate and our seasons. I just feel grateful for the opportunity to cultivate that awareness in an otherwise thoroughly modern and ever-modernizing world. Anthropologist Sidney Mintz makes the point that squirrels and many other animals instinctively collect and hide food for the future when they can. What humans do is different, less instinct than an invented, constructed, symbolically transmitted technology, he explains. In emergent human societies, cultural information, transmitted via symbol and language, enhanced ancient coevolutionary relationships. In fact, the development of agroecology cannot be separated from the human ability to symbol, argues theorist David Rindos. Language can be used to classify resources according to the amount and type of utility, both immediate and potential. Language in humans permits the preferential preservation of resources at times before their utility is apparent. Such behaviors, modified though they may be by symbolic factors, will vastly increase the ability of people to affect coevolutionary relationships that already exist. Genes were supplemented by memes as vectors of coevolutionary change. Information about cultivation, storage, and processing could be communicated and taught. The challenges of fermentation and food storage led to creative solutions such as pottery vessels that constituted major technological advances. Food storage capabilities reinforced the logic of generating surplus food, and surpluses drove the need for more effective storage strategies. Specialization and elaboration ensued. Food storage does not necessarily involve fermentation. In many cases, it primarily consists of keeping foods dry, but not too dry, cool, but not too cold, and dark. But it is not easy, with limited technology, to create ideal conditions for storage. Learning the lessons it takes to dry and store food effectively involves errors and accidents, seeds and grains getting moist, resulting in germination and/or molds, fruits and vegetables fermenting and/or rotting, milk aging in various environments, meats and fish faring quite differently depending upon moisture and salt content. Learning to understand the dynamics of how foods aged under different storage conditions was a necessary aspect of co-evolving with the more limited range of plants and animals that agricultural societies increasingly came to rely upon. Settling into a sedentary life, primarily subsisting on agricultural crops and/or milk or meat animals, requires such an understanding. Without it, agricultural societies could not have developed. Distinctions between fresh and rotten food are fundamental, both as a life lesson for survival and as a narrative theme in mythology across human cultures. Understanding what is and isn't appropriate to put in our mouths is some of the earliest cultural information we each acquire as babies. In the creative space between the binary opposites of fresh and rotten is the food that is effectively preserved, the cultured foods, the ferments so deeply embedded in our cultural particulars. Fermentation and coevolution. What is fascinating about the concept of coevolution is the recognition that the processes of becoming are infinitely interconnected. As a dynamic between two species, coevolution has been described as an evolutionary change in a trait in the individuals of one population in response to a trait of the individuals in a second population, followed by an evolutionary response by the second population to change in the first. Life, however, is never so simple as to be limited to just two interrelated species. Coevolution is a complex and multivariable process through which all life is linked. All the plants our hunter-gatherer ancestors ate, like those our primate ancestors ate, consisted of unique chemical compounds, along with enzymes, bacteria, and other associated microbial forms, to which our ancestors and their microbiota adapted. Or not, but they are not here to tell the tale. The plants' coevolutionary histories do not revolve exclusively around us. For instance, could certain large fruits have evolved to attract the attention and seed-spreading potential of extinct megafauna to our enduring benefit? Some plants we eventually co-evolved with in ways we came to describe as domesticated. We automatically think of domestication as something we do to other species, writes Michael Pollan in The Botany of Desire. But it makes just as much sense to think of it as something certain plants and animals have done to us, a clever evolutionary strategy for advancing their own interests. The species that have spent the last 10,000 or so years figuring out how best to feed, heal, clothe, intoxicate, and otherwise delight us have made themselves some of nature's greatest success stories. The influence of coevolution changes all involved. To say that one species is the creation or the master of another is a self-serving oversimplification. What we call domestication is a process that exists along a continuum, which ethnobotanist Charles R. Clement describes as running from wild to incidentally co-evolved, to incipiently domesticated, to semi-domesticated, to land races and modern cultivars, representing a continuum of human investment in selection and environmental manipulation. Like any coevolutionary process, domestication has repercussions for all parties. Coevolutionary success can lead to very specialized relationships. Tree shrews eating the fermenting nectar while pollinating the Bertram palms, discussed already, is one vivid example. With the major human food crops, our great investment in selection and environmental manipulation makes us obligate agents, meaning sufficiently dependent upon certain plants so that our survival at new densities is dependent on the survival of the plants. In that dependence, in all our cultural particulars, we are manifestations of coevolutionary processes with the plants as much as they are manifestations of coevolutionary processes with us. Humans are not the only actors in these relationships. Nor are plants the only other life forms to benefit from their close association with us. How about Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the primary yeast used to produce alcoholic beverages and bread? Yeasts are widespread in nature, but this particular one developed, through its long association with humans and our willingness to grow and process plants in huge quantities to its preferred specifications, to feed it generously and cultivate it continuously over the course of millennia, into the coevolutionary partner we now know as S. cerevisiae. Microorganisms are our most numerous servants, wrote Carl S. Peterson in a 1979 microbiology textbook, epitomizing a worldview of humans as the supreme creation of evolution, with all other life forms ours to freely exploit. To view ourselves as masters and microorganisms as our servants denies our mutual interdependence. Rather than Saccharomyces cerevisiae being the servant of humanity, it could be said that we are its doting fan and servant, much as we are to Vitis vinifera, grapes, or Hordeum vulgare, barley. Although we rarely pay much attention to them, we have also consorted with many varied lactic acid bacteria, LAB. By 2007, geneticists could state emphatically, every person in the world has contact with lactic acid bacteria. From birth, we are exposed to these species through our food and environment. The LAB's genetic diversity allows them to inhabit a variety of ecological niches, ranging from food matrices such as dairy products, meats, vegetables, sourdough bread, and wine, to human mucosal surfaces such as the oral cavity, vagina, and gastrointestinal tract. Comparative genome analysis suggests that in nutrient-rich niches, the LAB specialize efficiency by shedding genes for metabolic pathways they are not using. The specialized adaptation to milk is particularly interesting, notes the analysis, because this fermentation environment would not exist without human intervention. The selective pressure came not only from the natural environment, but also from anthropogenic environments created by humans. Who exactly is the servant of whom? Are the acidifying bacteria in milk or the yeasts in grape juice our servants, or are we doing their bidding by creating the specialized environments in which they can proliferate so wildly? We must stop thinking in such hierarchical terms and recognize that we, like all creation, are participants in infinite interrelated biological feedback loops, simultaneously unfolding a vast multiplicity of interdependent evolutionary narratives. Fermentation as a natural phenomenon. Fermented foods were not exactly human inventions. They are natural phenomena that people observed and then learned how to cultivate. Depending on the place, varying natural phenomena were observed, because different foods were being produced in surplus, processed in distinctive ways, and stored under specific conditions in each environment. The distinctness of cultures arises out of the specificity of place. Different plants and animals grow abundantly and produce surpluses, and different microbial communities develop on them. In China, rice and millet were developed, and their complex carbohydrates came to be digested by molds into simple sugars for alcohol fermentation. The discovery of the mold ferment in the Neolithic period is the result of the happy conjunction of three factors, writes H.T. Huang. Firstly, the nature of the ancient cereals cultivated by the Chinese, that is, rice and millets. Secondly, the development of steaming as a preferred method for cooking such cereals. And thirdly, the kinds of fungal spores that were present in the environment. As far as we know, the convergence of these distinctive factors occurred only in China. In the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East, it was barley and wheat instead that developed, and a very different method, germination, malting, that came to be used to digest them into sugars for fermentation. Both available foods and spontaneous fermentation phenomena vary dramatically between the extremes of tropical heat and Arctic cold. In cold climates, fermentation is absolutely essential for survival. In summer, when waterways are accessible, people catch fish, as well as birds, and bury them in pits, where they ferment for months until winter food scarcity requires their use. People in tropical climates are not driven by such stark seasonal imperatives, yet fermentation is no less important there. Hamid Dirar documented more than 80 distinct ferments in the Sudan alone. In tropical heat, rapid microbial transformations of food are inevitable. Fermentation is a strategy used to guide that transformation to create delicacies rather than decomposition. Sudan's foods are almost all fermented, notes Dirar. Clifford W. Heseltine and Hua L. Wang of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Fermentation Laboratory state, fermented foods are essential parts of diets in all parts of the world. Kraut Prayer. Eli Brown, Oakland, California. Myriad beings beneath my sight, thank you for your transformations. May you nourish me as I nourish you. May you thrive in me as I thrive on the earth. In all the worlds, may nourishment follow hunger as the echo follows the call. The War on Bacteria. The biological reality that bacteria are our ancestors and the context for all life, that they perform many important physiological functions for us, and that they improve, preserve, and protect our food, contrasts sharply with the widespread perception of bacteria as our enemies. Because the earliest triumphs of microbiology involved identifying bacterial pathogens and developing effective weapons against them, our culture has embraced a project that I call the War on Bacteria. We've heard for a decade about the war on terror, and for two decades before that about the war on drugs. Although it rarely gets named as such, the war on bacteria is much older than either of these, and over the past few generations it has indoctrinated almost everyone. Beyond antibiotic drugs that individuals take, sometimes for important reasons, but typically overprescribed, we routinely feed antibiotics to livestock, chemically sterilize our water, and use antibacterial soaps marketed with the seductive promise of killing 99.9% of bacteria. The problem with killing 99.9% of bacteria is that most of them protect us from the few that can make us sick. Continuous indiscriminate killing of bacteria in, on, and around our bodies makes us more vulnerable to infection rather than less vulnerable. Because of bacteria's genetic mutability, pathogenic bacteria are rapidly developing resistance to commonly used antibacterial compounds. The use of common antimicrobials, for which acquired resistance has been demonstrated in bacteria as ingredients in consumer products, should be discontinued, states the American Medical Association. The constant generalized assault of bacteria and the ideology that fuels it is misguided and dangerous. Those who hate and want to kill bacteria indulge in self-hatred, notes Lynn Margulis. As a result of the war on bacteria, our bacterial context is rapidly shifting. One bacterium, formerly ubiquitous in humans, Helicobacter pylori, which resides in the stomach, is now found in fewer than 10% of American children and may be headed toward extinction. H. pylori has been associated with humans for at least 60,000 years, and there is evidence that closely related bacteria have lived in the stomachs of mammals since their emergence 150 million years ago. Often people seek to categorize bacteria as either good or bad. H. pylori has been correlated with health problems such as ulcers and stomach cancer, and these have decreased along with the bacteria's incidence in the population. But even though H. pylori may contribute to problems for us, it is part of us, and we co-evolved dependent upon it for certain regulatory functions. Among the roles this particular bacterium is thought to play, or have played, in our bodies is regulating stomach acid levels, certain immune responses, and the hormones that control appetite. The disappearance of H. pylori may be implicated in increased levels of obesity, asthma, acid reflux, and esophageal cancers. The accuracy of classifying commensal bacteria as detrimental or beneficial remains highly speculative, cautions epidemiologist Volker Mai, because such classifications are based on examining their effects on only a few specific aspects of human health, and attempts have not been made to associate microflora composition with overall health. Microbiologist and medical doctor Martin Blaser argues that changing selection for our endogenous microbial populations is responsible for some of the emerging patterns in human health and disease, and suggests that H. pylori might therefore be considered an indicator organism for changing human microecology and disease risk. We eradicate our evolutionary partners at great risk. Cultivating a biophilic consciousness. As you listen to this book and experiment with fermenting foods and beverages, I encourage you to cultivate not only the specific bacterial and fungal communities necessary for the ferments, but a consciousness of ourselves as co-evolutionary beings, part of a greater web of life. Biologist Edward O. Wilson has dubbed such consciousness biophilia. While this word may be new, such a consciousness has been part of humanity since the beginning. Unfortunately, we have become increasingly isolated from the natural world, lacking awareness of and conscious interaction with animals, plants, fungi, and bacteria in our midst. Rather than continuing to distance ourselves from interaction with the larger web of life, we must reclaim these relationships. Fermentation is a tangible way of cultivating this consciousness and these relationships. As evolutionary beings, we must recognize in bacteria not only our cellular origins and mutualistic partners, but our best hope for biological pathways into the future. How else can we possibly adapt to all the toxic compounds and waste we are creating? Bacteria have already been found to decompose many pollutants, including rubber tires, organophosphorus compounds used in pesticides, plasticizers, jet fuel, and chemical warfare, and phthalates used in plastics and cosmetic products. After the horrific months-long 2010 oil spill from the Deepwater Horizon, the journal Science reported that the spill stimulated deep-sea proteobacteria that helped biodegrade the spilled oil. Fungi also offer promising detoxifying and adaptive potential. If our evolutionary imperative is to adapt to shifting conditions, then we must embrace, encourage, and work with microorganisms rather than attempting, however futilely, to eradicate them. Or imagining that we can engineer them to our will in precise and predictable ways. Coevolution affects all beings involved, too infinitely compounded to be predictable. We cannot control coevolutionary fate. We can only adapt to shifting conditions as best we can. There is no generic formula for adapting to change, yet we must. We can only transform by looking beyond the seductions of cultural innovation, the television, the computer, even the printed page before you, and reclaiming our cultural roots and biological inheritance. We must build community, not only with people, but by restoring our broad web of co-evolved relationships. The practice of fermentation gives us the opportunity to get to know and work with a range of microorganisms with which we have already co-evolved. Into the future they go, with us or without us. Fermenting Growth. Shivani Arjuna, Wisconsin. Learning to ferment opens people's minds to the possibility that they can provide for themselves in other ways they haven't ventured into yet. It's empowering.